I'm Dan Carell, CEO of the Digital Commerce Alliance, and this is Commerce Code, a bi-weekly digital commerce podcast for leaders in card linking, loyalty and digital marketing, mobile wallets and payments, and financial data. Thanks for joining this running conversation with leaders in the industry. And if you like this podcast, come join us at a Digital Commerce Alliance event. You can learn more at www.digcomall.org. Today on Commerce Code, I'm talking with Atif Mirza of VantageScore and Paul Siegfried from TransUnion. Commerce Code listeners surely know who those organizations are, but I will say that VantageScore is a credit score modeling and analytics company focused on innovation and financial inclusion. And TransUnion is a major credit reporting agency and a global information and insights company focused on building trust in global commerce. Today, we'll be talking about credit health for consumers overall and for Gen Z, the growth of BNPL, or Buy Now, Pay Later, and where that fits in, what it means for the outlook to 2025, and we do briefly contemplate what the world would have looked like if consumers in 1976 had had better access to bell-bottom jeans. Either way, stay tuned for the Gen Z consumer, BNPL, and an outlook for 2025, a conversation with Paul Siegfried of TransUnion and Atif Mirza of VantageScore. Commerce Code is brought to you in part by VantageScore. 8 of the top 10 banks and over 3,400 leading banks and fintechs use VantageScore to predict and manage repayment risk. Learn more about the latest advances in credit scoring and how to grow your lending business by leveraging financial inclusion at VantageScore.com. Paul and Atif, thank you so much for joining us on Commerce Code. It's great to have each of you back. Where are you joining us from? Maybe we'll start with Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Joining you from a home office today, but as always, I've been all over the country this week.
I understand that you generally have an undisclosed mountain redoubt. Is that where you are?
That's where I can be found this week, yes.
Got it. Atif, what do you think? Where are you joining us from?
Thank you, Dan, for having me as well. And I'm also a home office, Garden State, New Jersey.
New Jersey. Well, that's terrific. Well, look, we're here to talk about credit health generally, but, you know, Gen Z, BNPL, Buy Now, Pay Later, and then a little bit about 2025. These have been pretty perennial topics for listeners of Commerce Code. We come back to them every so often, and I don't think we've revisited the BNPL topic or the Gen Z topic for a little while. So we've got a credit score lens coming from Atif at VantageScore. Paul, obviously at TransUnion, you've got that lens too, but you've done a study on BNPL there at TransUnion to kind of try and shed some light on what has been, you know, somewhat of a opaque, like an area of the economy we don't understand super well. And so that's something I'm excited about talking about. So I wanted to start with you, Paul, just to kind of like at the very front end set the table. It seems to me that we don't know that much in the industry or as economists or whatever. We don't know that much about buy now, pay later. And I'd like you to talk briefly about like why don't we know that much about it?
I like the word opaque because there is some data out there. And the reason why there's not as much as maybe we find with some of our traditional products is that BNPL is relatively still very new. And when we think about that timeline, by 2019, there was a tremendous move towards BNPL in the market, both from merchants, but also adoption by consumers. But after that 2019 holiday season, we ran into a significant disruption in the economy that kind of distracted both consumers, regulators, lenders, et cetera. And so it's still very new, and we are still gathering data. We do have some data that has been reported to us, but not at this point in time enough for us to disclose reporting on the loans. But I will be able to share today reporting on the inquiries. So when we think about a consumer that is applying for BNPL, we do have access to that data. And so I'm going to be able to share that data today. So again, we've got kind of one half of the picture, but we don't have that other half of the picture yet.
Yeah, you know, I think of it as something that everybody in a sense knows, but doesn't really think about, which is the following thing. Credit scores are made up of a lot of information, but by no means are they made up of all the information, right? There's all kinds of information that theoretically could be used or that relates to our finances personally or whatever that, you know, just don't come in at all. And so when something like BNPL comes along, it takes a while for, and you know, in some cases it takes forever or whatever, it doesn't come in. Like, it takes a while for the new data to kind of be digested and become part of how we assess creditworthiness or we look at the economy or whatever. So it's, you guys at TransUnion took taken an early step to try and understand it better. We do want to talk today, though, about sort of credit scores, and we're going to talk about credit scores by age cohort. And we've got right in the title of the show here, we want to talk a little bit about Gen Z. And, you know, whenever this stuff comes up, I got to be honest, I always think like, wait, who are those people again? Okay, so here's the rundown, just for everybody's edification. I will say, having spent a little bit of time researching this online, yeah, there's no precise definitions for some of these things, but let me just start with this. Silent generation is before 1945. I think they say 1928 to 1945. I think this is also who they call the greatest generation, right? Is it? And then, okay, so now we're getting into boomers are from 1946 to 1964. Generation X, that's moi, 1965 to 1980. Millennials, 1981 to 1996. Gen Z is born 1997 to 2012. And so we sort of, you know, in terms of like looking at the economy anyway, we don't really talk much about anything past Gen Z. But I did sort of wonder and had forgotten, to be totally honest, what the next thing was after that. It turns out it's Gen Alpha. Why? I don't know. I didn't read that long, guys. But Gen Alpha is anyone born after 2013. I mean, even my children are solidly not Gen Alpha. And these things apparently go in 15-year chunks, which I don't know why, because it seems to me that that's like shorter than a generation, but whatevs. And, you know, there. So that's the generational breakdown. And we're going to be talking in a minute about sort of Gen Z. And I think it's like you could bundle together, as I look at some of the data that we were kind of preparing on, Gen Z sometimes looks like millennials. Millennials, again, are the ones just before. So millennials are born from 81 to 96, I think I said. And then Gen Z is 97 to 2012. So people that, you know, from my perspective are unimaginably young, essentially. That's it. Right. Okay. So we wanted to start, though, in general, you know, you guys have got literally like minute to minute data on overall credit health in the economy. We're recording this for the record on the 15th of November here in 24. So someone told me there was an election in the United States last week. So that, I don't think that's changing any of our conversation as far as the data here, but we're having a moment. It's kind of a hinge moment that I think historians will be dissecting for some time to come. And in that middle of that hinge moment, as we're, you know, looking at the data, Atif, I'd love to get your weigh in on, like, you know, what's the basic state of kind of consumer credit health?
Yeah, sure, Dan. So the average consumer, the fact is the average consumer is actually doing quite well in the United States. As we look at our VantageScore credit score, which stands at 702 as of October, data comes with 1 month lag. However, when we drill into various cohorts of consumers and the trends in various products, especially credit cards, we see some very interesting trends. Now, at VantageScore, we publish a monthly report, Credit Gauge, which provides this consumer credit insights and trends, is free, available on our website. And really, it talks about the core that includes delinquency trends, origination trends, balances, utilization rate trends. So according to the latest report, the new originations declined across all products compared to last month, September. And then when we look at credit delinquencies, they showed rising stress across all credit tiers, which is subprime, near prime, prime, and super prime. And then when we look at especially early stage delinquencies, they are improved slightly compared to last month of September. However, late stage delinquencies, which is 90 day and over, they continue to increase year over year, along with month over month. And now when we look at average loan balances, they generally rose, especially in the mortgage sector, they're reflecting larger loan amounts. However, balance to loan ratio or utilization rate declined for most products.
Atif, thank you for that. The kind of just get like lay the base foundation. And Paul, I'm interested to get your, I have thoughts on that, but I'm interested to get your comments or maybe your commentary on what Atif just said about the state of credit health.
Yeah, I agree with Atif on really the overall state of credit health. We see really on two sides, right? This incredible strength with so many consumers coming out of a difficult time, but we do see with that rising delinquency, a segment of consumers where it's not better than it was. And they're definitely feeling that stress, probably we believe as a result of that high inflation period that we went through, where not all consumers came through that with the same level of wage growth. So definitely they're feeling that stress. How it applies really to that generation, and I'm just going to pivot over to what does that mean from a generation standpoint? You know, I think that the one thing I want to call out is the generation we're talking about here, when you mentioned Gen Z, their oldest, if they're starting in 97, is they're about 27 to 28 years old. And so when you think about their financial maturity, whether it started at 18 or started at 21, they're early in their financial journey. They're early in their credit journey. And I think the one thing that we'll probably spend some time on today is understanding how early in your credit journey you compare, because the fact of it is that all of us at one point in time were early in our credit journey. And when you're learning about credit and you're an early user of credit, you have potentially, I'll say, a learning curve of how to use credit and how to mature with credit over time. And I think that's very much where our Gen Z is today.
Well, it's arguably more complicated, you know, just throwing in that BNPL piece now. I mean, if you could roll the clock back to, I don't know, the 70s or in 80s and stuff, you had layaway, I guess, to, you know, there are analogous products, but there's been a lot more kind of innovation in the financial space. I mean, it's not just, you know, there's credit products, but there's also just a ton of different ways to sort of do financial services now that younger people are more plugged into.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you go back to a 21, 22-year-old today versus a 21, 22-year-old boomer, if you just take the middle ground and just say 1955 and say 21 years later, you'd be in 1976, and you look at the products available in 1976 versus 2024, I think that you would say, okay, yeah, you have mortgages, you've got auto loans. But even in 1976, the state of credit cards was significantly different. You did not have near the access to credit cards then that you do today. So that's one. And then these other products. And it's not just BNPL in terms of financial products in consumers' hands. You also have many form factor changes. When I hold up a cell phone here, you've got apps, and these apps might hold a wallet. It might be a deposit-based wallet, might be some other credit form-based wallet. So definitely there are a lot more options and opportunities for consumers to conduct commerce today.
Just consider this, and I want to go over to you, Atif, but this strikes me as an important economic point. In 1976, consumers would have had vastly better access to bell-bottom jeans. Like, there would have been even more bell-bottom jeans in the world if there had been, right, this financial innovation that was. But no, they had to, like, save up for the bell-bottom jeans and then go buy them once they had the money. What kind of a society is that? Do we even want that? Anyway, the world has changed significantly, right? And it'll take more. I guess the other thing we could say, and this is true, I think, in financial services, not an indictment of anybody, but it's just how it is that the pace of, like, how we assess the economy. Because I think if you were to look at how economists, public policymakers, people in the industry think about core elements of the economy in 1976 compared to today, they'd be different, but, like, not that different. But if you look at how people live and function economically, it's pretty different. So Atif, you know, Paul's kind of started in on the Gen Z kind of, like, thinking about the situation for young people. And so wanted to just go to you. You know, if you roll the clock back, not to 1976, but just to 4 years and change now, in the moment when COVID hit in that 2020, you know, I mean, any future was imaginable. And in fact, the future that we currently inhabit was, like, best possible scenario, I think, for a lot of people. And yet younger people were sitting there in probably their most vulnerable moment, and I think could be regarded as the folks that, you know, you're most worried about, like, economically and career-wise. So I'd love to kind of get your sense of, like, how have Gen Z consumers kind of fared in the years since COVID hit?
So what we've seen, you know, starting from January 2020, which we consider pre-pandemic, Gen Zs and, for example, millennials also, across, you know, when we look at delinquencies and you know, if they're especially in credit cards and their usage, the balances, because of the lot of government assistance programs around, you know, in COVID leading into 21 into 2022, you know, you had mortgage forbearance, some of the programs had, you know, rental payments stopped, and especially student loan forgiveness and student loan forbearance. We saw, you know, slowdown of delinquencies in those early years in COVID. However, you know, a fast track into late 2023 and into 24, when high inflation and high, you know, interest rates, that hit these consumers pretty hard. And you see delinquencies going up across these consumer cohorts, especially in Gen Zs. But I want to highlight an interesting point, especially in 2024, what we saw when we look at the rate of growth across age groups. What we saw is that the delinquencies, in especially in credit cards for Gen Zs, actually grew at a lower pace than the, for example, Gen X. Gen X were the highest pace of growth in 2024. And same way, another cut of this data we look at by income class. And what we saw was that a lower income class had the actually lower pace of growth than the higher income class.
In delinquencies, in right? Delinquencies,
that's right.
That's an interesting, and I'd seen that kind of in the data and wanted to wait to hear it from you guys. But, you know, that we're talking about rate of growth for just in delinquencies. So we're not talking about absolute number or percentage or whatever, but, you know, rate of growth in delinquencies. And it was higher for relatively, like recently, for a relatively higher income category of people. And so I wanted to just pause on that for a minute, just because, I mean, you probably see that from time to time. I don't know, but I'm curious what if anything that means or what you take from that. Maybe, I don't know, maybe start with Paul and then come back to Atif on it, because I think you both see this.
I think that there are, especially in an economy with 300 million participants, there's never one thing. There's never one true driver. There's always many, many different drivers because there's just so many people operating and participating in this economy. But I think when you look at that, the fact that delinquency is up across the board and that income, you know, when you look at that increase in delinquency in higher incomes, now that delinquency rate is still relatively low, but again, the change is what Atif's referring to, is I think higher than what folks would have probably thought they would expect. I think one of the drivers, so I'm going to go down the path of what I suspect one of the drivers to be, is that we've just come through a period where consumers, no matter what their income, we had low rates and those consumers had this opportunity to acquire more debt, potentially acquiring more assets in terms of mortgage growth. We saw the fastest pace of true mortgage growth we've ever seen because many of those mortgage rates were 3% or under, which really provided, you know, at least in my case, once in a lifetime opportunity to finance at such a low rate. I remember my first mortgage was 7.6%. And I thought, oh my God, it would never go lower. You know, just thinking back to those mid to late 90s. When we think about not only mortgage, but then you think about the cost of an auto and the financing of an auto, you have an auto loans that are well in excess of what they were just 5 years ago, yeah. Where an average auto payment today is $750. And so when you put all of this acquisition of debt together, I think that's really one of the key drivers to that higher delinquency rate, is that consumers have borrowed more, no matter what their income is. And I think that that has created some situations where, you know, we've really seen that delinquency rate then get driven up. I think with the Gen Z, and I'll just kind of bring us back on that one, Gen Z and lower income, when you're younger, you tend to have less experience and you tend to make a lower wage. And despite that, I will say that when we think about Gen Zs, their willingness to participate in the credit ecosystem, while it was kind of slightly out the door, slightly behind millennials, their participation rate, though, seems to be higher. And when we conducted a study, we looked at their participation when you think about ownership. So 22 to 24-year-olds in 2023 versus 22 to 24-year-olds in 2013. And we found that Gen Z had a greater participation in both card and auto lending. And it was fairly significant. And what that means is there's a comfort level with Gen Z to enter and participate in the lending ecosystem.
It makes sense, right? That you'd get different behavior, different attitude. And I there's probably a whole generation. I know there's a whole generational theory about, you know, that we observe about how, like, to take the extremes, what we'll call the silent generation, like literally my parents, people in their 80s and that kind of stuff, and their attitude towards credit. And then the attitude towards credit that's, you know, probably still evolving, right, for Gen Z. Again, there's a longer conversation there, but that stuff isn't locked yet, right? Like these are still, you know, it's going to be contingent on the experiences that they have and they're developing, you know, their careers and their home economies and all that kind of stuff in a world that includes, you know, different kinds of products. You know, I want to talk a little bit about credit card utilization. And again, thinking about the generational stuff, so sort of Gen Zs, millennials being the younger folks, I wonder how we see that right now, how credit card utilization has been lately. We'll start with Atif. Paul, I'd want to get your comments. And this, I think, also includes the kind of question, or it bakes in the question of, where does the buy now, pay later thing fit in? Because, you know, from a lot of people, you know, from the consumer's perspective and like from a pure economist's perspective, there's not really a whole big difference between using one kind of credit versus another. But again, like the way that we have access to the data is really different. And so, Atif, let me just start with, what do you see in credit card utilization for Gen Z, let's say, and then I'd be interested to hear what you've learned lately.
So again, credit gauge data, we show these trends from pre-pandemic. And when we look at, these consumer cohorts from, let's say, last year and a half, Gen Z, if we look at the regular trend, the Gen Zs come out on the top with the higher utilization rate, especially in credit cards, followed by millennials. But again, I'll talk about the rate of growth, which is an interesting pattern. And, you know, what we see is that especially in 2024, we saw that the Gen Z had the lowest rate of change among other age groups. And really the Gen X had the highest rate of change in utilization rate. And similar pattern, if you look at who's applying for new credit in originations, for example, again, Gen X and Gen Z, if you look at a regular trend, they are the one applying for new credit card accounts. But in terms of rate of growth, Gen Z were the lowest among other generations.
And just as a reminder, Gen X is people that are between 45 and 60 years old, which is difficult to imagine given how cutting edge and cool we are. These are people who wore parachute pants in high school. I mean, you take something to pull that off. So that's just for reference. But I always get confused because I think Gen Z and Gen X are next to each other. They're not, right? It's Gen Z and millennials that are kind of like, to me, a little bit more adjacent. Paul, you had thoughts and follow up to that on credit utilization.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one, I want to agree with Atif in terms of that 24 growth rate has been lowest for Gen Z. However, if you go 2 years prior back to 22, Gen Z was the highest growth segment. And I think part of this was availability in 22 versus in 24. I think we have seen lenders contract in terms of making new loans available while originations are still relatively high. On the history of a bank card perspective, originations have declined for two straight years. So that's definitely a factor that, again, Gen Z is going out looking for options. Again, there's many options that are out there, and cards certainly being one of them, and they're apt to go get them or use them. The lines that they have are going to be lower. And why? Because, again, they're going to be newer to credit than these other cohorts in terms of age. And when you're newer to credit, you're still in that learning period. You're developing your credit experiences. And so as a result, you're going to get lower lines, probably less likely to be approved than someone that's more credit established. And I think the reason that that's important is that then drives us to the question of why BNPL is popular for younger consumers. And I think that, you know, the underlying reason is, if consumers don't have access to credit in one place, but they can gain access to credit in another place, they're naturally going to gravitate that way. You know, just think about water, right? So water will find the path of least resistance. Certainly, someone that's a credit seeker is going to look and to find that path of least resistance as well.
Yeah, I mean, I did a BNPL thing once just for the sake of doing it, like to understand this thing. And okay, so there you are. And I think it was four payments is it 4 months in a row? I mean, is it always organized the same way, Paul? You probably know this off the top of your head a little bit more. And I obviously
There's
haven't used
different
it.
Different versions. I would say the most popular version would be four payments over a 6 week period. So pay a quarter of it today. And then every 2 weeks, you're making a quarter payment. So you complete the payment in about 6 weeks.
In a sense, it kind of lines up with a typical 2 week paycheck deal. Out of any other comments, I guess, on BNPL, I don't know how you guys see it or think about it where you're at VantageScore, because again, like the data isn't available in the same way. But any thoughts, I guess, on can you see even indirectly how BNPL fits in or where people are using it?
So, yeah, unfortunately, we are starting to get that, but it's not available in our models yet.
But is it consistent even? I mean, this is part of it, right? It's like it's not like you wouldn't have it for everybody, would you?
That's right. Again, it's not much visibility at the moment on my side.
You know, as I said earlier, like I think people kind of know this, but we don't think about it necessarily. There's a lot of things we do economically that doesn't go into our credit score. you know, at least has conventionally not. There's just a ton. And so this is, on the one hand, it might seem to people like, well, that's weird, right? Here's a whole thing that is essentially a credit line that is, you know, invisible. But it's like, well, yeah, but I mean, rent and like your bank account and all kinds of other stuff that would be probative doesn't come in. And really, VantageScore has been on the cutting edge of trying to fix that, right? And trying to expand that. And it has really positive impacts on, especially on people who are not, you know, in the upper quartile or whatever of incomes. And so there you go. I just have an observation, I guess, that I don't know if you guys may or may not have a reaction to, but, you know, when I think, you know, we started at the top by saying, and I think on paper it's true, you know, the average consumer is doing quite well, but I think we all know, and this has been going on for years at this point, that is true on paper. That is, you could say, true in quote reality. And yet if you were to just walk around with a microphone on the street and talk to people and be like, hey, how's it going economically? How's the blah, blah, blah? We know, and I think this may have been conventional wisdom, is that this certainly informed what happened in the election last week, is the average person's like, no, it's terrible, it's bad, eggs cost $1 million, whatever. And so, and I liken it to the following thing, right? I've had this experience, probably a lot of people have. You go to the doctor and you're like, my knee hurts, right? And then they're like, well, we did a thing. We did an x-ray, we did a whatever else, you know, I felt your knee, I don't know, I hit it with a hammer and it's fine, right? And you're at this sort of impasse. And then there's the question of what the doctor is going to do about it. At that point, it becomes sort of an exercise in empathy or the lack thereof, because from your perspective, you're like, my knee hurts. And from the, you know, professional perspective, it's like, well, it's fine. And so I think that's kind of like where we're at right now in the economy. I mean, I don't have a solution, but to me, that's sort of descriptive. And I think that probably plays into the politics of it anyway. Is that, you know, people don't, because I'm very much in the side of like, you look at the numbers, you do the, you know, you do the calculations. There's a bunch of different things that you could say that will make people's head explode about how things are going well, because like, not nobody believes it, but not many people believe it. I don't know if you've got a perspective on that. You know, maybe we'll start with Paul and then go to Atif, only if you've got something to weigh in on. But Paul, you usually are willing to speculate irresponsibly. So, you know, you got anything for me?
Sure, Dan. Yeah, I think what you described is what I would call reality. Yeah. And oftentimes, when we look at macro things, right, our macro economy, we look at the averages and we say, hey, wage growth overall has kept pace with inflation. However, underneath that, while borrowing has in some categories kept pace with inflation, in other categories, it might be slightly behind. It all boils down to what does it mean to that individual consumer wallet? And, you know, my view is that consumers, some specific consumers, have taken on an amount of debt that, again, some at a very low cost, some at a very high cost, meaning mortgage at 3%, but a credit card at, I think on average right now, around 23%. And each one has that cost, but it has a utility attached to it. And at the end of the day, there's a payment that needs to be made. And what those interviews or man on the street positions would lead me to believe is that there's a segment of consumers that have not benefited as much by the wage growth, but they have experienced that inflation, the cost of goods. They have most likely borrowed to keep up that standard of living. So you're using a credit card effectively to manage that cash flow shortage, to manage that standard of living. And when it's time to make that payment, you don't feel that those wages have gone up, because for you, maybe they have not. And thus you're now in a position where delinquency is rising, where you're having to manage between multiple payments. I think that's a very real scenario. I do think that there are segments, I'll use the senior segment, if you're on a fixed income, for example, certainly the cost of living increase was higher than it had ever been a couple of years ago. However, did it keep up with inflation? I think many of the seniors that I've spoken to would say no, they don't feel that. And so I think that creates really that stress that you're referencing. I don't feel as good as I'd like to feel. Mm-hmm. And the result is if they've got to make decisions over which things to pay, we then see that delinquency rate rising. So, I think that's the way I would explain it. Again, the overall economy numbers, those macro numbers are very strong on a historical basis. Yet, you know, what does that really mean on the individual level? I think that's where you tend to find those issues.
So, yeah, Atif, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, absolutely. So to echo what Paul is saying, you know, when we look at VantageScore prime segment, which is consumers with 661 to 780 scores, and this is the segment very, you know, near and dear to the lenders, what we've seen is that the delinquencies, prime is the largest share of, they have the many lending products with over 50% of all credit cards, for example. And we've seen increased delinquencies, especially in this segment. One thing we've seen is that the prime segment has shrunk year over year, about 1%. That makes up about almost 2.4 million consumers in the spectrum. And then what we've seen is the delinquencies have risen, especially in 2024, about over 50% rate of growth for this segment. And when we look at these consumers, these are the consumers with a lot of them owns their homeowners. Maybe they're doing fairly better because they previously owned homes, but especially people who rent, they are the one struggling quite a bit because you saw rents going up significantly in last year and a half, 2 years timeframe. So for lenders, I guess that's the, you know, this is the consumer segment. That's the, you know, that would be more impactful for their bottom line and something to watch for also.
Yeah, I mean, we won't get into this particular point, but I think, you know, all the change and uncertainty, you know, your point about, like, you know, the delinquencies rising in 2024. I mean, there's a lot of different factors, as Paul has kind of laid out, too, that play into it. We won't talk about the following thing, but like the student loan thing has been like on and off and on and off. And who knows what, you know, happens next with the whole deal. But the point is, like, that's a significant just like ground level reality payment that people either do or don't need to make. It was off for the longest time. Then it was on. Then it was maybe. And now who knows what. And so I think that, you know, that creates that, just like psychologically creates that sense of uncertainty or reinforces it. But it's also like an actual check that needs to be written. And so we'll see, right, like how much, I mean, there's probably somebody out there hopefully studying to the extent that, because you had very inconsistent behaviors in terms of like payment, didn't pay, whatever, in the last year since student loan payments sort of kind of started again. And that'll have an impact too, right? Like for a certain and different, for different like categories of people. Last thing, and just a quick word from each of you, I want to just take a quick look to 2025, because believe it or not, we are almost there. When I see numbers, I used to say this about 2020, when I see numbers like 2030, like I just like wrote that down in something, you know, I'm like, that's ridiculous. That's the future. That's like Star Trek. That doesn't exist. But anyway, we're going to be there before long. 2025, though, is kind of like one of those numbers. You go, what? What? Anyway, 2025 is going to happen in a month and change. And would love to kind of get your sense of any thoughts on, you know, from what we can tell, what do we think is going to come up, you know, in the next year in this space that we've been talking about? And maybe I will stick with Atif, and then we'll come back to Paul.
So when we look at these trends in 2024, again, the two of these cohorts, the prime consumer segments, you know, lenders has to watch for them because the delinquencies have grown over 50% for them, right? So they really have to keep a close eye on this group's performance. And then secondly, the high earners are also under pressure. It's a similar situation. Delinquencies among high income earners surged by 95%, especially with increased white collar layoffs, you know, and more competition for jobs. We expect the headwinds for these households in 2025.
All right, great. Well, Paul, close us out here. What do you think as you look forward to next year?
Yeah, I think that for the most part, I agree with Atif's view with those segments. I think to go a little bit further down and bring us back to our age segments, I think for Gen Z, one, they have opportunities as far as access to products that, you know, other generations have never seen because of products did not exist. And I would expect to see the demand for those continue. One stat that I had not thrown out was that when we looked at inquiries on BNPL products here this year, we saw about 35% of the share of BNPL inquiries fell in those consumers that were 29 and under. So certainly the largest segment for BNPL were really those Gen Zs. And I think whether it's BNPL, whether it's credit card value propositions, or even cash type of applications, meaning cash wallets, I think that consumers today have access to more than they've ever seen. And I think that we'll continue to see that happen. I think we'll continue to see growth in those categories. Again, these are younger consumers. These are credit developing consumers that have access to more than they've ever had. And I think that they'll continue to diversify their use of those tools.
Great. Look, I want to thank both of you for being on. And I will reiterate something or just plug something here. Atif, along the way, you mentioned Credit Gauge a couple times, and just for listeners who haven't checked it out, VantageScore, it's just a thing that anyone can have access to. You go to VantageScore, or if you just kind of like Google credit gauge, VantageScore. You're gonna find it in kind of regular reports on all the stuff that Atif was talking about. So that's available to the public. So look, I want to thank both of you guys for joining us today on Commerce Code. We look forward to having you back, and have a great, I guess it's Thanksgiving next and Christmas and all that. So have a great holiday season.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. Best to you and all of our listeners as well.
Commerce Code is sponsored by Pentadata, the all-in-one financial data API. Whether it is bank account data, credit card transaction data, or credit reports and credit scores, Pentadata has it all in one simple and easy-to-use API. With coverage of over 6,000 banks, over 200 million credit files, and 60 million merchants, you can get all the data you need for your apps at pentadatainc.com. Commerce Code is a bi-weekly podcast bringing you conversations with executives who are leading the way in digital commerce. If you like Commerce Code, your company should join the Digital Commerce Alliance and become part of our mission of advancing trade for good through standard setting, industry networking, conferences, and best practice sharing. Check out our website at www.digcomall.org. On behalf of DCA, have a great week!